Morning, today's Daf and Sanhedrin, Daf Mem. We are starting today on Lamed Tes and Beis. We are finishing up the Agadah from yesterday, finishing up the Perek, and then we begin a new Perek. Yesterday, within the Gemara, we find ourselves a little bit more than halfway down on the Amud. We're starting with the Simanim Kra, Zakah, Be'adom. We noted yesterday in the course of the Agadah various conversations that took place between the Minim heretics that lived at the time and various Talmidei Chachamim. Rabbi Gamliel got a lot of playing yesterday's Gemara as he had to deal with the Minim, as he dealt with the heretics and had to answer a lot of the questions. And so that took us through a good part of yesterday's Daf. Ksiv, we mentioned in the course of the discussion yesterday, Achav. The reason why Achav came up yesterday is because the Gemara wanted to make clear that to the witnesses, as they're about to testify, they're going to be a little bit hesitant. They don't want to kill somebody based on their testimony. So we say to the witnesses, no, look, if the guy did the crime and he was a murderer, so you do want to testify, because then we get to execute the murderer and bavod rishayim rina. That when a Rasha dies, so that brings joy into the world. The Gemara noted that by Achav we have a very similar idea. Achav was killed, and Achav was a Rasha. He was a bad person. And when he died, so that brought joy into the world. And so we had a similar idea by Achav. So the Gemara quoted the Pesukim regarding Achav. And, you know, as the Gemara's want to do, so once we're on Achav, so the Gemara is going to quote some ideas and Pesukim regarding Achav. So Ksiv, the Gemara here quotes the following Pesuk, Vayikra Achav, El Ovadyahu Asher Al HaBayis. Va'ovadya Haya Yerei Hashem Ha'od. So who was a Navi at the time during the Malchus of Achav? So it was Avadja. And the Navi describes Avadja in extraordinarily complimentary terms. He calls him a Yari Hashem Aod, exceedingly fearful of Hashem. So my Kamakram, Rav Yitzchak Amar Levi Yaakov, Ksiv, Nachashti, V'Yavachani Hashem B'Glalech. So the Gemara goes on to explain. I'll tell you why it was necessary for the Pasuk to do that. Because we know Yaakov visited Lavan. And we know Lavan's house received a bracha as a result of Yaakov's visit. And when I say visit, by the way, I do mean 20 years. It's more than just a visit. So, Nachash v'erechen Hashem b'galalech. B'Yosef siva yivarech Hashem as base ha-mitri b'galal Yosef. We also know Yosef was in the house of Potiphar. We also know that house of Potiphar received a bracha as a result of Yosef being there. Beis adahu garva lo hava mivrach. So now, Ovadja, who presumably, quote-unquote, is a tzaddik, so now he's been sitting in the court of Achav for years. I don't know how long, but anyway. And meanwhile, Achav's house did not receive a bracha. And so this could be reflective poorly on Ovadja. So Shema lo yare elokim ata, yatsa basko v'amor, Ovadja hava yare sa Shema od. So that's why the Torah had to go out of its way. The Navi had to go out of its way to say, no, it's not true. He was a yare Shema od, exceedingly fearful of Hashem. So the Navi is basically reporting, this is not an Ovadja problem. This is an Achav problem. Achav was so bad, he was so wicked, that he couldn't even have a tzaddik in his house and receive the bracha from the tzaddik. That's how bad Achav was. As far as the flattery is concerned, as far as the compliment is concerned, Ovadja received even a better one than Avram. You'll notice it said that Avram was, Torah describes him as being good, so as a Yari Hashem, but not Yari Hashem Aod as it describes by Ovadja. What act did he do to be zoche for nevuah? Hid 100 neviim in a cave. So Izavel went after the neviim, and she did a good job going after them. Unfortunately, so Avadja took 100 of the neviim to hide them from Izavel and her wrath. So, Maishna Chamishim Ish. Why did Ovadja take the 100 and divide into two caves? So, Amar Avalazar Miyakov Lamach and Amar Vayamachana Nishar Lif Leita. So, one idea, which is something which is taught to all of us at a very young age. So, Yaakov, when he went to war against Esav, so he prepared himself in three ways. One of the three ways that he prepared himself is for a battle, and he took his camp and divided into two. If one was to be annihilated, at least there would be a Pleita, there would be remnants. And Ovadja, years later, did the same thing. Took the 100 Nevi'im, was afraid if, in fact, they were discovered, so all of them would be destroyed, so broke them up into two and two. Two groups of 50. Rabbi Abahu Amar Lefisha Ein Ma'ara Machzeg Yosef Mechamishim. Gemara gives a second answer, really a pragmatic one. Cave doesn't fit more than 50. In other words, there apparently was a standard cave, and a standard size cave didn't fit more than 50. Chazar Avadja, the Gemara quotes from the beginning of Sefer Avadja. Obviously, he's one of Treasar, and now historically we know to put him in the time of Achav. Koamar Hashem Elokim Le'edom. Now, Avadja, which is, by the way, the Haftorah for Parshas Toldos, so he gives Nevuah to Edom, which makes sense because, wait, Toldos now I'm second guessing myself. I may be right. Maybe Toldos. Okay. I'll look it up afterwards. Sorry. But anyway, but it has to do with Esav because the progeny of Esav is Edom. And you're looking up for me. Thank you. So the progeny of Esav is Edom. And so it's appropriate to read Sefer Avadja after having just learned about Esav. So he's giving Nevuah to Edom. So it's a little bit strange. You have basically a Navi Yisrael who's giving Nevuah for a nation of the world. It's no different than Yonah. Right. Toldos is Malachi. Okay. And then the next one? All right. So maybe... Yeah, when is that? Where? It's which one? Vayishlach. Okay. Because at the end of Vayishlach... Okay, got it. Because at the end of Vayishlach, it goes through the entire generations of Esav. Got it. Okay. Sorry, I was off by two parshios. Oh, I was good for second guessing myself. I was bad for not looking ahead of time. Anyway, Maishna Avadja LeEdom. Why is Avadja giving Nevuah for Edom? Amar Rabbi Yitzchak Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu Yavo Avadja Hadar Ben Shnei Rishayim. Because look, Avadja who lived amongst two Rishayim, meaning he lived right between Achav and Izevel. Okay, not literally, but in other words, he surrounded himself with Rishayim. And he was able to maintain a certain integrity, not a certain, a high integrity, despite the fact that he associated with Rishayim. And meanwhile, Esav, Edom, which is Esav is the father, so lived amongst Tzadikim, he lived with Yaakov, he lived with Yitzchak, and Lolamad Mimaseim. And he was unable to learn from them. And he maintained a bad disposition, despite the fact that he lived with good people. Amar Ephraim Miksha Tamidosha Rabbi Meir Mishum Rabbi Meir Avadja Gera Domi Hava. The Gemara gives another approach, which is that Avadja actually was not born Jewish. He was born from Edom. He converted and he becomes a Navi. Behind the Dharma Inche Mine Ube Ava Nizoba Narga. So the Gemara points out that it explains an old adage, which is that how do you chop down a tree? Using the tree itself, meaning the wood for the axe that's used to chop down the tree is coming from the tree. In this mashal, so the Navi who's going and giving prophecy against Edom is somebody who was himself from Edom. Gemara quotes... that they killed Moab. Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai Adam Inshi Mine Ube Ava Lezo Be Narga. And again, this idea that the destruction comes from the source itself. In this case, David killing off Moab. David was a descendant of Moab. Ki Asar Avdimi Amar Yerach Mitoch Masrachas. The Gemara just gives another way to express this idea that the thigh, it disintegrates in of itself, meaning that the decomposition of an item usually is internal and comes from itself. Okay, as long as we're here, or as long as we're discussing something regarding Edom, so the Gemara over here is going to be discussing as long as we discuss Moav, sorry, we segued into Moav. As long as we discuss Moav, the Gemara here is going to very briefly discuss one of the kings of Moav by the name of Mesha. Right, the most popular one we probably know is Eglon, but the Gemara here quotes from the Navi, and this is regarding Mesha, the king of Moav. Unfortunately, what was popular back then was sacrificing one's own son. So Mesha, the king of Moab, did that. In fact, he sacrificed his own son. Now, did he do so for a good reason or for a bad reason? Now, the truth of the matter is it doesn't really matter, meaning there's no good reason to sacrifice your own son. But at least what was his kavana? Was it L'shem Shemaim or was it L'shem Avodah Zarah? So Rav Shmuel Chanamar, L'shem Shemaim V'Chanamar L'shem Avodah Zarah. So at least there's an opinion that says that Mesha Melech Moav killed his son, but it was L'shem Shemaim. Now, even though it was L'shem Shemaim, obviously, it was perfectly incorrect. It was perfectly wrong. But at least his intention was good, according to one opinion. So Bishlam Laman Dam L'shem Shemaim Ha'andichli V'yi Ketzav Gadol Al Yisrael. Now the Gemara points out that, now the Navi actually comes out good, if in fact it's L'shem Shemaim. Because if it's L'shem Shemaim, then we understand the reaction HaKadosh Baruch Hu gets angry. Well, why is it, why? Why is Hashem getting angry when, I'm sorry, angry at the Jews when Mesha kills his own son? That seems like a strange response. But if his actions were L'shem Shemaim, so at least HaKadosh Baruch Hu now is thinking, or to our limited understanding, looks at us and says, hey, look what he's ready to do L'shem Shemaim. Meaning, obviously, it's not right what he did, but at least he's ready to do that L'shem Shemaim. And you, the Jewish people, what are you guys ready to do? So you understand why Hashem gets angry at us. It reflects poorly on us. So the Gemara says, but if it's Avodah Zarah, so I don't understand. So then what's the anger? Meaning, what Mesha did was perfectly incorrect. Meaning the action was no good, and even the intent was no good. So the Gemara says, so then I really don't understand. So the Gemara says, "Kid Rav Yeshua Bar Levi, Rav Yeshua Bar Levi Ramiksiv, uchemish bate agam asher sviv asechem lo asisem, uksiv uchemish bate agam asher sviv asechem asisem." So we don't behave like the non-Jews. Sometimes we do. Kimisukanim shebehem lo asisem, kimukokalim shebehem asisem. Meaning, you behaved and you emulated even the worst behavior of the non-Jews that are surrounding you. And it's just a reminder to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that, look, this is, in other words, what Mesha did was perfectly incorrect, but in other words, and then reminds HaKadosh Baruch Hu that, and look what we're emulating, and look what we're modeling. The Gemara quotes from this parsha one more time in the Navi from Malachim Beis. I'm Rabbi Chanina Bar Papa. Yardu Rishaim Shal Yisrael LeMajega Tachtona. The Gemara says this euphemistically. The enemies of the Jews, meaning the Jewish people, went down to the lowest depths, and meaning that we even involved ourselves in sacrifice of our own children. Vanar Yafa Ad Ma'od. The Gemara over here, quoting from the beginning of Sefer Malachim, describing Avishag, she was exceedingly beautiful. The Gemara is quoting this over here because we just a couple of minutes ago discussed this idea that Avajah was Yare Elokim Ad Ma'od. So we're going to now find another place in Tanakh where it says Ad Ma'od, and that's referencing Avishag. Am Rabbi Chanina Bar Papa Adain Lo Yia Lechati Yofi Shosar Dechsev Ad Ma'od Velo Ma'od Bechlal. So the Gemara points out that although Avishag was beautiful, but not just a fraction of the beauty of Sarah. Gemara in a number of places describes the beauty of Sarah. It comes to my mind the beginning of Masechet Megillah in the first parak over there through the section of Agadita. So it describes the beauty of Sarah. So the Gemara over here says that even though Avishag was beautiful, she was not as beautiful as Sarah. Hadrolach Echad Dine Mamonos, that is the end of the fourth parak of the Masechet. We are now starting this morning the fifth parak of the Masechta. We start with the Mishnah. It is an extraordinarily long Mishnah. Much like we saw in the first parak, where all the Mishnahs were front-loaded at the beginning of the parak. Here too in the fifth parak, same thing. Although, as you could just turn a couple pages in, you'll see the parak over here is very short. We're finishing this parak in Daf Yomi language in nearly the blink of an eye. Right, it's 2.5 blot, this fifth parak of Sanhedrin. It's really interesting. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about Kiddush Levana. All the halachas of Kiddush Levana come from tomorrow's daf. So tomorrow's daf and Sunday's daf, between those two. So that's exciting. Stay tuned for that in the fifth parak of Sanhedrin. We begin with the very long Mishnah. We are now back to the procedure within the courtroom. Okay, Rashi tells us. First Rashi, I know we didn't have started the Mishnah yet, but just in terms of where to put this Mishnah. Asidra demasisin desalik minekai. This goes back to the procedure that we discussed back in the previous parak. Achar she'emu aleim ayubot kenoso. First, what we did is we intimidated the witnesses. Remember, the Gemara had a number of considerations of what we're going to say to the witnesses in order to scare them straight, make sure that what they're reporting is perfectly honest, and they are not concocting some sort of story. So back then, we discussed various things that we said to the witnesses in order to make sure that they're giving an honest reporting. And now, after that, we are picking it up right there in the Mishnah, because now we're actually starting with the examination questions. We discussed this before, but let's discuss it now again. In terms of the examination questions, we're going to break it down into critical questions, or let's call them chakiros, and not such critical questions, we'll call them bedikos. Okay, now, granted, by the way, there has to be some sort of middle ground, meaning because chakiros basically are establishing two pieces of information, when and where. When did the crime take place? Where did the crime take place? Now, and the bedikos are non-essential questions. What was he wearing at the time? What was the victim wearing at the time? Where did it take? The tree that was nearby the crime. Did it have thick branches or thin branches? And a lot of peripheral questions. Now, there has to be some sort of middle ground, meaning there are questions which are clearly essential, even though they're not answering the questions of when and where. Like, for example, what happened? Meaning, what was the actual crime itself? Now, without establishing what the crime is itself, we don't have a case. So even though we are beyond the questions of when and where, and we're not onto the ancillary peripheral questions of, you know, what was he wearing, there obviously are questions which are necessary just to put a case together. We get that. We understand that. But in terms of making a division between questions, we're going to go with chakira versus bedika. Chakira is establishing when and where. We cannot establish these witnesses as witnesses until they can establish when and where the event took place. Now, when really can be summed up in one of two questions. When and where. However, as we'll see in the Mishnah, the when is actually going to be subdivided into six different questions. Because when is now going to be placed on the calendar in terms of which sabbatical cycle, which year, which month, which date, which day, which hour of the day. So the truth of the matter is, it all really comes down, even though it was broken down to six questions, but really it answers one question, which is when. And then where, we ask with one simple question. Where? Where did it occur? These 6+1 questions really establish the chakiros of the Mishnah. These are the 7 chakiros which we're just going to keep hammering again for the remainder of today's daf. And as we'll see in the Mishnah, these are essential. If one of the witnesses is unable to come up with when and where the event took place, that's it. Now, when I say that's it, by the way, I'm going to show you Rashi a little bit later on this morning. That's it, meaning the case is thrown out. Even if there are other witnesses who know when and where it happened, it doesn't matter. If one of the designated witnesses is unable to answer the question when and where, it's all thrown out. The entire case is dismissed. It's a disqualification of all the witnesses. I'll show you the Rashi later on, where Rashi says that explicitly. Okay, I say all that by way of introduction to the Mishnah. We begin the Mishnah inside. So like I said in my introduction, the 7 chakiras are really answering the questions of when and where. When is just simply divided into 6 questions. Which sabbatical cycle? Which year? Which month? Which date? Which day? And what hour of the day? And then, in terms of makom, we just simply say, where did it happen? Rabbi Yossi Omer Beis Yom Beis Hashah Beis Hamakom. Now, Rabbi Yossi is just going to reduce it's the same question of when and where. He just takes the when and he reduces it down to 2 questions. So, which day and which hour? And later, the Gemara is going to explain what exactly is the machlokas between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Yossi. Makir no samoso. Did you recognize the perpetrator? Now, it could be describing the perpetrator, it could be describing the victim as well. Rashi over here says that we're talking about the actual victim. Okay. Yes.
So why would there be a victim?
Tomorrow, that's the first question we're going to be dealing with tomorrow. It's an excellent question. The Gemara is going to address that. He tartembo, back to the Mishnah. Did you give a warning? As we know, no punishment can be issued against a defendant unless he was first warned. And the warning, which we're going to be discussing a lot throughout this Masechta, is a very strict process in which the warning has to be issued. He has to acknowledge that he heard the warning. He has to then not only acknowledge he heard the warning, but accept the consequences of his actions before he actually does the crime. So it's very specific, and we're also going to have a debate later on, which we touched on earlier in the Masechta, who's the one who has to issue the warning. Do the witnesses themselves have to issue the warning, or can the warning be issued by somebody else? Another issue which is subject to debate. So the warning is very specific. It is very detail-oriented. We will come back to that later on. However, avodah zarah is mi'avod uvame avad. Let's say this is a case of idolatry. So therefore we ask, what was the idol that he worshipped? How did he worship the idol? Kol amar b'bedikos harei zeh meshubach. The more questions you ask, the better you are at obtaining a factual depiction of what happened. A line which we're going to hear a lot in this Masechta, when Ben Zakkai presided over a case, so he asked the question of the thickness of the fig tree that was surrounding the area. Now, the fig tree was, how relevant was it to the actual crime itself? Or was it just simply a backdrop to the crime? We're going to be discussing that later on in the Masechta. Ma ben chakiros abedikos. Gemara now points out, we have two categories of questions. Chakiros, essential. Bedikos, not so essential. So the Gemara points out that there is a fundamental difference between them. Chakiros echad omer ani yodei, I do some betela. By chakiros, an answer of I don't know is an unacceptable answer. It is a disqualifying answer. When one of the witnesses says that I don't know to when it happened or where it happened, so we throw him out. And as I pointed out, we throw everybody out. It disqualifies the entire case. Now, why does it disqualify the entire case? Rashi over here writes, I'm reading the Rashi inside. Rashi Dibur Amaschal Chakiros. It's the last narrow lines of the Rashi. Deshevach Chakiros Mikrai Nafgalan. So as far as these seven questions, we're learning them out from Psukim, which we're going to see in the Gemara. Now, these questions will result in Hazama, meaning that what we need in order for a witness to be an eligible witness is we need him to be eligible for Hazama. Now, of course, we don't want him to become muzamd, but we need that eligibility in order for him to be a witness. Now, if he says, I don't know to when and where, so he's no longer eligible for Azama. Because Azama means you have another set of witnesses say they were with us at the time. The only way you can make that argument of they were with us at the time is only if they establish when and where it happened. Once one of them is no longer eligible for Azama, it knocks out the entire testimony of everybody else. Ve'afilu, and Rashi here makes the point as strong as he could. Ve'afilu hein mea. Let's say you have 100 witnesses. And in the examination of the 100 witnesses, one of the 100 say, I don't know when it happened. So we throw everybody out. De'ein edim nasim zomemim ashir zimukulam kedamrin b'meseches makos. Because the Gemara Makos, which we've already discussed once earlier in this Masechta, the Gemara Makos says that you only have the possibility of Azama when all of them are eligible for Azama. And if one of them is not eligible for Azama, none of them are eligible for Azama. And here in our Gemara, what we're learning out now is one of them says, I don't know to the Hazama questions. For the Azama eligibility questions, what it does now is it knocks out the entire case. Okay. Bedikos, back to the Mishnah. Bedikos echad amrein yodeh, v'afilu shayim amrein ein anu yodim edusim kayemes. Now for a Bedika question, an answer of I don't know is acceptable. And even if both of the witnesses say I don't know, that's also acceptable. Now again, I'm going to go back to a point that I made earlier, but just to make sure that this point is clear. Meaning, obviously, if one of the witnesses can't even testify to the crime itself, so then we don't even have a case. So the I don't know, which is an acceptable answer for a bedika, has to be for tangential questions. Right? Questions which are not, you know, not facts on the ground that establish that a crime actually occurred. Like backdrop questions. What was he wearing? What was the what did the tree look like nearby? However, even in a bedika question, the ancillary questions, if there is contradictions between the two witnesses, so then that's dismissal. That's a disqualification and the case comes to an end. Now, in establishing when, one of the questions, as we already discussed, is going to be the date of the month. What is today's date? Now, let's assume that they operated only with a Jewish calendar. So they knew it's the month of Elul, right? Right? Didn't we just celebrate Rosh Chodesh? Yeah, that was yesterday. Okay, good. So what's today in terms of Elul? Which day of Elul is today? So hopefully I'm going to report the right answer. Today's the second day of Elul. Okay, good. So it happens to be that I know. But I know that today's, right? Today's the third day of Elul. Oh, today's Friday.
Today's Friday, yes. Okay, excellent.
What a great demonstration of me not knowing the date of the month. And by the way, and also it kind of missed my point because I was going to say in today's the calendar is fixed. Okay. Oh, today's Friday. Wow. That happened quickly. Okay. Today's the third day of Elul. So the so back then it made it even harder. Okay, I was successful in not reporting today's date with a fixed calendar. Okay, back in the good old days, it was even harder because, as we know, you have two eligible days for which day is going to be Rosh Chodesh. It's either going to be the 30th or the 31st day of the month, like we've discussed many times. And who made that determination? Beis Din. And then everyone got an email or a text blast from Beis Din saying that today's Rosh Chodesh. Back then, however, they weren't holding by that. So how did they report the message to everybody that Beis Din established today Rosh Chodesh? Word got around. It's perfectly understandable, says the Mishnah, that not everybody found out which day was Rosh Chodesh. So if one of the witnesses says that today was the second day of Elul, and the other one says, no, today's the third, so the Mishnah says that's understandable. And that does not cross the witnesses, and we can hold by their testimony. However, Zemar B'Shosh V'Echad Amar B'Chamisha Yidusam B'Tela. One reporting that today's the third day of Elul, and the other one's reporting that today's the fifth day of Elul, even when Rosh Chodesh is a moving target, but there's only one of two possible days that Rosh Chodesh can be. So if one says three and the other says five, that's just simply inadmissible, and that it becomes a disqualification. Now, they're reporting what time in the morning the crime took place. Now, back then, they didn't have watches. So in terms of what time it was, they looked outside. Now, on a cloudy day, it made it even more challenging. But let's assume the sun is out. When the sun's out, you have a basic idea of which hour of the day it was. They took in a day and they divided it into 12 hours. And the first 6 hours, obviously, was the morning. The second 6 hours was the afternoon / evening. And so if one witness reports that it took place during the second hour of the day, and the second witness says it took place during the third hour of the day, that's fine. I mean, in other words, they're basically looking at the same time. A one-hour discrepancy is perfectly acceptable. However, but one says third hour of the day, and the other one says the fifth hour of the day, that's inadmissible. That testimony crosses one another, and we have to assume now that they didn't see the same event. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Kayemis. Now, Rabbi Yehuda is okay with one reporting it was the third hour of the day, and the other one reporting the fifth hour of the day. In the Gemara and Tamar's Daf, we're going to explain what kind of in terms of actual time. What kind of discrepancy are we looking at? Echad amar b'chamish ve'echad amar b'sheva yidusam b'teila. Shebechamish chama b'mizrach v'shema chamash b'marav. However, even according to Rav Yehuda, who allows a two-hour discrepancy, not hours 5 and 7, in hour 5, the sun is in the eastern horizon, of the eastern hemisphere of the sky. In hour 7, the sun is in the western. So there's no way that two witnesses are looking at the same event, checking the sun, and making that kind of mistake. It's impossible. Or they're lying. In other words, but we're not going to accept their testimony, not even according to Rabbi Yehuda. We check out the second witness. We ask him all the questions that we asked the first witness. We already made this point earlier. Each witness is examined on their own for obvious reasons. Because if the second witness hears what the first witness is saying, so he'll just repeat answers. So we check each witness individually. If now it's a match, so now we have a case. And now we're going to start deliberation. Poschen bizchus, a point we made earlier, but the Mishnah is now repeating. We open up, this is a capital case. So we open up by saying, well, the Mishnah actually earlier didn't tell us what we say, but if you remember the Gemara back on Lamed Aleph, the Gemara gave a number of suggestions of positive things to say for an acquittal. Meaning we're, like we've said time and again, the agenda now in a criminal case, in a capital case, is that we're looking for an acquittal. If we have to convict, we're going to do it. But we're looking for an acquittal. Amar echem in eidim yeshu lamed alav schoso, echem in ataminim yeshu lamed alav chova mishatken oso. If one of the witnesses now wants to make an argument, whether for conviction or acquittal, we say to the witness, no. Your job is testimony. Your job is not to provide any kind of argument towards the deliberation. If you remember the Gemara back then, we quoted Rashi. Rashi explains the witnesses would be self-serving if trying to deliberate, because once now the trial is en route, and once we're headed towards a conviction, remember the witnesses themselves could themselves become the defendant in the case of Hazama. So once they offered testimony, that's it. They can no longer contribute to the deliberation. What about students? Students can contribute to the deliberation, but only for arguments of acquittal, not for arguments of conviction. Now, if one of the students wants to make an argument towards acquittal, so he is elevated towards the bench, and he gets to stay there for the remainder of the day. Now, that's just for talking up. Now, let's say he's got something good to say. In other words, there's intelligence to his argument. So then we show him law. So then we listen to him. Who also can contribute to the deliberation? The defendant himself. The defendant himself has the right to defend himself in the procedure. But again, he's got to say something intelligent. Meaning, if he is given the opportunity to speak and all he's doing is just yammering, so then we say, okay, enough, and we go on. Now, if we're headed towards an acquittal, that's what we do. We vote, we acquit, the court case is done. And if we are headed towards a conviction, we're not going to convict today. We're going to end the court session. Have everyone pair up for back and forth deliberation, and hayu mamata mamachal velo yishosin yayin. Minimum amount of food, but enough so that we could think straight. No wine, obviously. In other words, we don't want to impair judgment over here. Kol hayom venosim venosim kol halayla. And then in terms of that night, so interesting, Rashi. Rashi says that night every judge goes home to his own house and it sits with his own thoughts. Right? Rashi says, kol halayla ish la'atzmo. Interesting, Rashi. Right? In other words, for the night, they don't talk to one another. They sit by themselves. Ulamachras mashkin ravayin labezdin. Now the next day we're coming back to Beis Din. And in terms of where we resume deliberation, so everyone can resume where they were yesterday. Meaning if one judge was debating acquittal yesterday, so he starts with acquittal today. And if a judge is starting with conviction yesterday, he starts with conviction today. Can they turn on their argument? Some can, some can't. We've already discussed this point before. The Mishnah here. This is the Mishnah that we've discussed, that we quoted earlier. If you were arguing a conviction yesterday, on day two you can open up with now changing your argument to deliberating acquittal, but not the opposite. You can't argue acquittal yesterday, wake up today, and argue conviction. A reminder that we discussed back also in the Gemara earlier, and that is that even though this is true, meaning with the Mishnah, what the Mishnah is saying is absolutely true, for the actual vote itself, even if you've been arguing acquittal throughout, you can vote conviction. That was what Rav taught us earlier. The Gemara tried to disprove his position, but the Gemara did not. Rav's position stands. That at the end for the vote, you can vote whichever way you want, even if you've been arguing a certain way the entire time. Let's say you forgot what you argued yesterday, which is kind of hard to imagine, but again, it's possible. So don't worry, says the Mishnah. We have the stenographers. The stenographers wrote down everything that everybody said and the basis for the argument. So when you're coming in day two and you start off by reporting what you said but incorrectly, so the sofrim are going to remind you, no, that's not what you said yesterday. And here's what you said yesterday. Okay. Now, if we're headed to an acquittal on day two, that's fine. But if now we're headed to a conviction, so here's how it could look. If 12 say that he's innocent, 11 say that he's guilty. Remember, this is a capital case, so 23 judges. So 12 innocent, 11 guilty, the man goes free. Or the woman. Shnaim asam mechayvin ve'echad asam mezaken. Ve'afilu echad asam mezaken ve'echad asam mechayvin ve'echad omer in yodeya. If we have 12 saying guilty, 11 saying innocent. We have 11 saying guilty, 11 saying innocent, and one saying I don't know. Even if we have 22 going in one direction, but with one I don't know, ve'afilu esrim v'shnayim mezaken o mechayvin ve'echad omer in yodeya, yosifu adayanim. In any one of these examples now, we have to we don't have a vote. Meaning, let's start off with the 12-11. 12 convict, 11 are acquitting. It's no good. Remember, we learned this on day one of the Masechta. For a conviction in a capital case, you need a majority of at least two. Now, I understand with 23, that doesn't work. In other words, it's either going to be a majority of one or a majority of three. Right? It's not going to be it's not going to be a majority of two. But, okay. And the Gemara earlier dealt with that. But you need at least a majority of two. So you're not going to get it if 11 are acquitting and 12 are convicting. So what do? So we're going to add two judges. The Gemara now goes on to explain this. And even if, before we go on to the Mishnah, I'm just explaining now the next case in the Mishnah. And even if we have 22 voting in one direction, and one says, I don't know, we don't have a court. Because the I don't know is not a vote. Saying I don't know is not tantamount to going one way or the other. It's not a vote. You need a minimum of 23. We're going to add judges. So in either event, how many judges do we add? V'kama mosifim? Shnayim ad shivim ve'echad. You keep adding a pair of judges. Now, it's not necessarily going to help. Meaning, let's say we had 12-11. 12 convicting, 11 acquitting. We added two judges. The two judges we added split. One convict, one acquitted. Okay, we're going to keep adding two more judges. And it could come out now that our final number as we get to 71 judges is that we'll have 36 convicting and 35 acquitting. It could be. So, ad shivim ve'echad. Shoshim v'shishim mezakim v'shoshim v'chamishim mechayvim zakai. V'shoshim v'shishim mechayvim v'shoshim v'chamishim mezakim. So if 36 are now, if the final number of the 71 judges is 36 acquitting, 35 convicting, the man goes free. If, by the final court of 71, we have 35 acquitting and 36 convicting, so now we have a problem. We can't add any more judges because 71 is the max, and we don't have an acquittal, but we also don't have a conviction. We are right now in no man's land. So what do? Danim elu keneged elu achiru echem and mechayvim divrei mezaken. So basically what we're going to do now is that we're not just simply going to end the case. Somebody's going to have to change the vote. And what we're going to do is we're going to now go into a deliberation until somebody changes their mind. Now, admittedly, the Mishnah says that we're going to have somebody who was voting for a conviction change his mind to an acquittal. The Gemara earlier pointed out the opposite could also be true, meaning somebody who was voting an acquittal can turn now and vote a conviction. The Mishnah is kind of just hoping that we'll go headed towards an acquittal rather than a conviction. On the vote. The inability to change is only on the deliberation. The ability to change on a vote, you could change. That's, again, the Gemara asked that question against Rav.
But the thing is, in order to have a vote, don't you have to have a psak, like a logical argument behind it? So you're changing it, and say you're changing
right.
Your argument.
It's really interesting, by the way. It's like a debate team. In other words, you may have started arguing a certain way, and you have to maintain the argument. But even in the course of your argument, you have come to the realization that you're wrong. And even though the law demands that you continue that argument, but when it comes to the vote, you'll vote. And it's interesting. Do you have to give a reason at the vote? It doesn't seem that way.
I thought that the scribes actually wrote everybody's rationale.
Correct.
And argued the day before.
Correct.
But isn't that the basis for their vote?
I mean, it's the basis for their argument. It's the basis for the argument. Okay. Minahani Mili. Okay. After now, so that's it. That's the Mishnah. And that's the end of the Mishnayos in terms of the fifth parak. We're done. We're done with the Mishnayos. And the Gemara's discussion over here, as I mentioned in the beginning of Shir today, it's going to be a very quick discussion in terms of Shas. Meaning it's now just two dapim of Gemara discussion on all the Mishnayos we just learned. Now, the next part of the discussion over here is going to be extremely technical. I'm going to go through it quickly, But basically, it's the drushas that get us to the seven questions. Okay. Where in the Psukim do we see that there are seven questions that are asked? So what we're going to do is we're going to take three parshios, actually in terms of where we are, in terms of Parsha Shavua. So it's last week's Parsha and this week's Parsha. So in terms of where we're situated now, learning the daf, it's perfect. Literally perfect. So take a Parsha from last week in Parsha's Rei, take two parshios in this week in Parsha Shoftim, and you put them together, and you're going to come out to the number seven. Last week we learned about Ir HaNidachas, a city where the majority of the members of the city are worshipping idolatry. So those who worship idolatry are going to be killed, but not with the normal idolatry punishment of Skila, but they're going to get Sayef. For reasons which we're going to learn why later on. I mean, the why is very simple, because the Torah says so. But maybe we'll give more understanding of why that is. And in terms of the money of that city, all the possessions of that city are accumulated into the center of the city and burnt and destroyed. This week's parsha, we're going to be discussing a case of idolatry, simple idolatry, not Ir HaNidachas, and also Einam Zomamim, this week's parsha. So we're now looking at the psukim in Ir HaNidachas, Avodah Zarah, and Einam Zomamim. And the Gemara quotes the psukim. V'darasha v'charkarta v'sha'alta heitev. So, I'm counting. Darasha's one, charkarta's two, sha'alta heitev. That's three. Now Rashi points out the word she'ela by itself doesn't mean a chakira, but she'al sha'alta with the word etev, that means a chakira. V'omer. So that's last week's parsha. Now, this week's parsha. V'ugad lecha v'shamata v'darashta etev. So, v'darashta is one, etev is two. Okay? And etev over here, meaning darashta doesn't need a etev. So darashta is one, etev is two. So three from Ir HaNidachas, two from Avodah Zarah, and then v'omer, v'darshu ashotim, etev. So Darshu is one and Heitev is two. So our numbers now are three, two, and two. Add them up together, you get to seven. And those are the seven chakiras. To which the Gemara asks now on the top of Memam and Beis. I don't understand. If the whole point over here is to give us the seven examination questions, the seven most basic examination questions that are asked in each and every capital case, why doesn't the Torah give us the seven words in one capital case, and that serves as a binyanav? What we're doing is we're piecemealing together questions from this case, questions from that case, questions from that case. Well, how do we know it's 3 plus 2 plus 2? Maybe it's, in the case of Ir HaNidachas, 3. In the case of Avodah Zarah, 2. In the case of Edom Zomimim, 2. Gemara answers. Kevan de kula bahadi adad iksivim mehadade yalfe. Well, the Gemara says, they're so similar to one another, and because they're so similar to one another, therefore we can conflate the parshios together and add them together in order to get to the number seven. The Gemara says, what are you talking about? These cases are not the same. Yes, they're all capital cases, but they are differentiated. And the Gemara now goes on to explain the differentiation of these cases. Consider. In Ir HaNidachas, the money of the people are going to get destroyed. In Avodah Zarah and in Edom Zomimim, your money doesn't get destroyed. Avodah Zarah la'anach tarti lo'dam yishakem b'sayef. And Ir HaNidachas is notably unusual. Avodah Zarah is different than the other two because Avodah Zarah, the punishment is skila. By Ir HaNidachas and by Edom Zomimim, the punishment is sayef. Now, by Edom Zomimim, by the way, the punishment is sayef in a murder case. In Edom Zomimim, the punishment for the Edom Zomimim is going to be whatever the defendant himself is going to receive. So it's not necessarily going to be saif, but what we're saying over here is that most of the time, the case is a murder case, and so by Edom Zomimim, most of the time the punishment is going to be saif. Okay, although admittedly it's not always the case. Now, Edom Zomimim lanach tartel odam yishkein tzrich and tzrich masra. Now, Edom Zomimim is unusual in the following sense. By Ir HaNidachas and by regular Avodah Zarah, a warning has to be issued. By Edom Zomimim, for reasons which we're going to discuss later on, no warning by Edom Zomimim. Okay? So how can you tell me, oh, they're all the same, and therefore we're conflating the parshios together in order to arrive at the number seven? They're not all the same. So Behetev Hetev Yalfinu Me'adadu Gzereshava Mufna. So the Gemara says, you're right, they're not all the same. How are we learning, how are we conflating each one of the parshios? Through the mechanism of Gzereshava, it says the word Heitev in each of the parshios, linking them together. And the Gemara says it's Gzeir Shava Mufna. Now, every time we have the Mufna discussion, it basically means like this. The word that's used for the Gzeir Shava is perfectly superfluous. And had it not been superfluous, we wouldn't be able to make a Gzeir Shava. Meaning it'd be a weak Gzeir Shava. De'ilo Mufna ikla Mifrach. La'aya Mufna Mufna. The Gemara says, yeah, you're right. It's a Gzeir Shava Mufna. Now, midahava le lemichta vidarshu v'chakru, v'shani kra b'dibure, behetev, shma min alaf nuye. Because the Torah could have just simply said vidarshu v'chakru, which are words indicating examination. By virtue of the fact that the Torah adds the word heitev, which was unnecessary, means that it's a gzeir shava mufna. The heitev word that's used in every one of these parshios, linking them together, is mufna, superfluous. V'akati mufna mitzad echan hu, bishlam ahanach tarti mufna hu, bishum da'ava lemichtav. Ela irani dachas mai hava lemichtav. Now the Gemara points out that the irani dachas parsha, last week's parsha re'ei. So, over there, the Gemara is arguing, the word mufna is not superfluous, but the haksi v'kulu. So, hasam nam efnui mufna medahava lemichtav derosh, tidrosh, o chakor tichkor. The Gemara says, no, even by the irani dachas parsha, it's superfluous, because the Torah could have just used the double language. Derosh tidrosh, chakor tichkor, v'shanikra b'dira b'ra b'heitev, shma min alaf nuye. By virtue of the fact that the Torah could have gotten away with not writing the word heitev, even in the irani dachas parsha, and wrote the word heitev, so now it tells me that in all three locations, the word heitev is extraneous, and that allows for egzer shava mufna. V'asu, now, what do we have so far? Egzer shava linking these three parshas together, telling me that I need the seven essential questions to be asked in any one of these capital cases. Now let's think about it. What capital cases do I have now under that's covered under the Pesukim? Irani Dachas, which is a Saif, Avodah Zarah, which is Skila, and Edom Zomimim, which is typically Saif. So I got Skila, Saif, and Saif. But it still doesn't tell me that I have examination questions by Sreifa and by Chenek. How do I know that it covers every one of the capital cases? V'asu nechnakim b'kavachomim niskalim, u'minayragim, v'asu nisrafim b'kavachomim niskalim. So the Gemara says, well, like we've said a number of times, there's a pecking order to the capital cases. Skila going on top as being the harshest, followed by Sreifa, followed by Chenek, followed by Herig. Other way around. Followed by Herig, followed by Chenek. Okay. So once we've established that, Skila requires the seven examination questions, so then anything below it for sure is going to require the seven examination questions. Hanichal Rabbanan Darmi Skila Chamura, Rabbi Shimon Darmi Sreifa Chamura Ma'ikal Amemar. A machlokus which we're going to be referencing a number of times. Rabbi Shimon does not have the pecking order where Skila goes on top. He has Sreifa going on top, the reason for which we're going to discuss later in the Masechta. But he has Sreifa going on top. So now, according to Rabbi Shimon, Skila is pegged as the number two capital punishment. And the source in the Torah for Chakira, for the seven Chakiras, is only by Skila. According to Rabbi Shimon, Sreifa is on top of it. And I don't have Psukim by Sreifa. So what do I do? Elam Rav Yehuda, v'hinei emes nachon, v'hinei emes nachon, ha'chad srei. So what Rav Yehuda says to answer this question is, the words emes nachon are actually going to give us another four more drushas. So we already have seven. We're going to add four. It brings us to the number 11. Sheva l'sheva chakiras dal tlasik zereshava pashtu uchada l'Rabbi Shimon l'asui nisrafen. So now, how does the breakup of 11 drushas going to work? Seven for the seven chakiros, three to link them together, and according to Rabbi Shimon, one more drasha to include Sreifa. Because according to Rabbi Shimon, Sreifa is on top, and I can't learn it out through a kavachomer. And the Rabbanim milsa dasi bekavachomer tarf v'kasav lakra. And according to the Chachamim, something that's learned out through a kavachomer, the Torah anyway teaches us. Megadif ba Rabbi Abau. Rabbi Abau hears this pshat, and Rabbi Abau is, I'm going to use nice language, amused by that pshat. He didn't like it. Emel asui shmona chakiros v'shmona chakiros mi'ika. The Gemara says, well, if I have 11 drushas, so why don't I apply 8 towards the chakiros? Alam alav aika lasui bekama b'shah. We can ask which minute of the hour it was. V'tanya nami acha yibolken also b'shmona chakiros. And there is a brisa that describes 8 chakiros. Answers the Gemara. Hani chalabaya libe d'ramer d'amar ein adam tov v'loklam. U'lahaklish nami d'amar adam tov mashu shapir. Now, according to Rav Meir, a discrepancy, an allowable discrepancy between two witnesses is either zero or just a small bit of time. So then I can totally understand that asking which minute of the hour, at least according to Rav Meir, is acceptable. But Elala Abaya Aliba de Rabbi Yehuda Damar Adam Torah Chatzis Shav LeRava Damar Tau In Shituva Michael Amemar. But as we're going to learn together tomorrow's daf, according to Abaya, according to Rabbi Yehuda, people are off by a half an hour, even as much as an hour. So it's not fair, it's not reasonable to ask which minute of the hour the crime took place. Ela Asuya Bekama B'Yovel. So we can ask which Yovel year was it? Hainu Be'ezah Shavu. Well, isn't that the same question as which sabbatical year? Ela Asuya Be'ezah Yovel. Which Yovel cycle did this crime take place? Which means that we could be looking at a crime that's at least 50 years old. V'Ida Chivin D'Amar Be'ezah Shavu L'Abaya Be'ezah Yovel. And then the other will tell you, no, once we're asking which sabbatical year it is, so included in that is also the question of which Yovel cycle is it as well. Okay, so where do we stand right now? We learned the Mishnah, procedure in which we are examining and cross-examining the two witnesses. What are chakiros? What are bedikos? The requirement of chakiros, it really is twofold. Number one, it's learned out from Psukim, like we just covered for the last 20 minutes. And also, it makes the witnesses now eligible for hazama, which is a necessary component in order for the witnesses to give testimony. The Mishnah went in terms of what's going to happen in terms of the deliberation and in terms of the decision. And what happens if we see an acquittal coming? What happens if we see a conviction coming? So all those details we learned together in the Mishnah. And the Gemara's discussion, quite frankly, was just a question of technicality. How do we arrive at the seven chakiros? A question of drasha, a question of how to darshan, a very technical discussion of the Gemara in terms of how we got to the number 7.